Okay, good evening, everyone. Looks like we have a number of people who are still trickling in. See some familiar faces here from Agudath Shalom and some new faces of friends who are coming on from Facebook, I presume. Ah, welcome, Bubby and Sadie. Good to see you. It's always good when the grandparents join the Shiurim. All right. And looks like, okay, just a little bit of background before we start. I think we'll jump right into it because our friend and colleague, Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb, needs to jump off at 8:20. So first of all, welcome to all the Agudath Shalom folks who are here. I first want to acknowledge the presence of Toby Schaefer, our president, who has joined us this evening, as well as Marina Sapir, who's the head of our adult education, and a number of our friends who are joining us for this special session. So the way this kind of came together is, what do we call it? A preacher, a teacher, and an outreacher. So I think technically I'm the preacher. Apparently I'm very preachy. Yair is a teacher. He'll talk about himself in a moment in Jewish education. And Stephen Gottlieb, works in Kiruv at an Ish Shul. So you'll tell us more about that in a moment. I don't want anyone to think that we are the sole great experts on the topic of Kiruv or even the subtopic of modern Orthodox Kiruv. What my friends, Rabbi Lichtman and Rabbi Gottlieb, are doing with me today is really just recreating an experience that we had a few years ago when we were in Smicha. The three of us were in Rabbi J.G. Schachter's Chabura together. And aside, of course, for the free pizza that was offered, which always a huge commodity when one is in yeshiva, it was very fun. You know, we had our armchair discussions about the future of modern Orthodoxy and how things are progressing. So this is really us kind of missing that and having withdrawal issues. So we're coming together once more to have a fun armchair discussion about just our personal perceptions, particularly tonight on modern Orthodox Kiruv. But of course, if you enjoy this armchair conversation that we are having, we welcome you to let us know. And of course, if this does become a thing, not just a one-off, we may want to have guests on. And we welcome you to let us know what you would want to hear about next and who you think might be an interesting guest to have on the show, because that'd be a great opportunity to diversify the people that we bring on. So without any further ado, I want to turn the mic to Yair. We're not going to call each other rabbis. We're all friends over here. And then to Stephen.
All right. Thank you, Moshe, Rabbi Kirks, to many of us, to myself included. So just by way of brief introduction, my name is Yair Lichtman. I went to school, as Moshe mentioned, with Moshe and Steve. Now I'm teaching Gemara to middle school students at Westchester Day School, and I'm hoping in general to build a career in Jewish education primarily, but not exclusively. For me, I really enjoyed preparing for this topic and getting into these issues through a number of academic presentations, essays written by people like Adam Furziger and Jack Wertheimer, as well as a little bit of my own experience with a couple of Kiruv or quasi-Kiruv type of experiences. I hope we'll have the opportunity to reflect more on that as we chat together today. Steve, you're up.
All righty. Hello, everyone. Thank you to Moshe for the kind introduction. My name is Stephen Gottlieb. I am an Avreich, which is essentially a Beit Midrash fellow at Beit Midrash Zichron Dov of Toronto. This is an affiliated institution with both Yeshiva University and Torah Mitzion, as well as the rabbinic educator at the Village Shul Eshet Torah Learning Center, which is also in Toronto. A truly special shul. People of all observance levels come together to sing, daven, and do all of that fun stuff with each other.
Great. So I'll take it from here just to give a couple of, more targeted pieces of introduction into the conversation that we'll be having. The first is that the conversation doesn't really make that much sense without defining our terms. And so I'm going to provide a sort of very rough definition of what we mean by the term Kiruv, and hopefully that'll be a little bit interrogated by everyone here, including Moshe and Steve, but also everyone else. What I mean by Kiruv, and I think we'll use the term Kiruv to denote, is programming whose goal is to attract less affiliated Jews to greater Jewish religious affiliation. We're going to be deliberately vague about whether that means, within a denomination or cross-denominationally, And even about what it means to affiliate, if that means something with regard to belief, to practice. And hopefully we'll, you know, raise some of those issues as we chat. But I think just as a working definition of pure, that's how we'll use it. We'll also not try to define modern orthodoxy too precisely. I think the books have been written and the symposia orchestrated that try to define modern orthodoxy. Many of us are here with our own definitions of the term. And I'm sure some of those differences will come to bear also as we weigh what modern orthodoxy and pure have to do with one another. But just, we're not going to try to define it. Gedolim v'tovim imenu have tried, and with mixed degrees of success. And the final piece of introduction before I think we'll start the, you know, conversation more formally, is that, you know, in the Zoom space, it's always sort of challenging to orchestrate conversation effectively. And I think we're all trying our best to, you know, make this a engaging and interactive environment, and not one where, you know, we are sitting on our high thrones, preaching the gospel. I leave that to Moshe. And so the way that we think is most effective to do that is to sort of have an open chat throughout. So if we're saying something that you agree with, that you disagree with, that you have a different perspective on, or an anecdote that illustrates a point or something that's worth sharing, we'd love for the chat to be happening throughout. Even while we're talking, please feel free to interrupt us by sending things in the chat. We'll be monitoring it, and there may be things that catch our eye and our interests. And we'd love to invite people to share their perspectives as well in this, you know, verbal context. But just to have the chat be available, I've noticed already one person's used it, and I hope many will by the end of this conversation.
Yes, thank you, Rabbi Avi Hoffman, for acknowledging our urgent Jehovah a shout out. Good to have a fellow member here.
Just to also say, in addition to monitoring the chat on Zoom, I will be monitoring all comments on the Facebook for both Moshe's video and my own. So anyone who is not in the Zoom room but still wants to participate in the discussion is welcome to, even from the live stream.
So I think with those excessive words of introduction, we could finally get to the rub. So the question I'll start by posing to Moshe and to Steve is, you know, we're talking about modern Orthodox Kyiv here. That's what we've chosen to title this conversation. What does it mean for Kyiv to be modern Orthodox, or to be denominational in any sense? What are we talking about here?
So I'll just jump in there first, since I unmuted first. I think in order to talk about what modern Orthodox Kyiv is, we might want to first talk more broadly about what Kyiv is definitionally, even though I know we started with a vague definition, and then talk about how modern orthodoxy finds itself as a perhaps unique subset within that. So the easiest entry point for me in understanding Kyiv, so Yair, like you pointed out, it's about doing, I forgot your term, using outreach to bring in those who are less affiliated. You know, I'm trying to think like halachic terms, how we define this discussion, right? It should obviously be from a Jewish perspective. And I think the most classic go-to place is the mitzvah of tochacha, translated, of course, as rebuke. But of course, as many Akronim point out, today it's not about getting on our soapboxes and preaching about how evil your ways are and you should be closer to tshuva and return and repentance. But actually, you know, people are more creative. They invite you for Friday night meals, hear some challahs, and bring people in closer. What I think might be unique about modern orthodoxy, and we could discuss this, is that I think, you know, if we think of modern orthodoxy, I know defining that is a whole other discussion. Modern orthodoxy, we try to be intellectually open. Sometimes we just become as dogmatic as our friends on the right and the left, but we want to be intellectually open. And one of the challenges is that sometimes those who are involved in Kyiv, it's my goal is to convert you to my cause and belief system. Modern orthodoxy, that can start getting a little uncomfortable, perhaps not just emotionally, but philosophically, where one might prefer to educate as opposed to advocating for what their belief system is. Let me put all the material out there on the table. I hope you come to the same conclusion as me, but I won't hold any qualms if you don't. So, you know, that'd be my initial impression of it.
And I would just add, I think Moshe did a tremendous service by framing this in halachic terms, all three of us and many people over here are Talmidim of J.J. Schachter, Rabbi J.J. Schachter Shlita, who was very big on the idea that you can't have a discussion without bringing Torah into it. That as rabbis, our goal is to have everything we do be on the basis of Torah and mitzvos. On that note, I want to add just another way of framing Kiruv and then go into what a particularly modern Orthodox Kiruv might be able to look like. And that's rather than through the lens of Tochacha, but that's a good lens to look at it as well. I prefer looking at it through the lens of Hashavat Aveda, the returning of a lost object. That Judaism is fundamentally about learning Torah and fulfilling the mitzvot that come from it. And in fact, every single Jew in the world, regardless of denomination, regardless of personal identity, has a share in that Torah. Torah tzivu lanu Moshe Marasha Kilat Yaakov. It is the inheritance of all of the people of Israel. And as rabbis, as educators, as leaders of the Jewish community to be, we have an opportunity and in fact an obligation to return that to people who, for one reason or another, no longer have access to it. Not in order to create a cookie cutter army, but in order to return to a sense of authentic Jewish ethos, practice, and just general sense of community involvement that may have gotten lost along the way. Being able to bring back the textual identity of what it means to be a Jew, and in fact, what it also means to be an Eved Hashem, a servant of our creator in this world. And again, that doesn't mean everyone comes out of it the same way. That means that people bringing their identities, their practices, their own style into it fully, but understanding that being Jewish is not only about certain slogans or particular involvements in youth groups, but really about Torah. And that Torah has something to say to each and every Jew, no matter what vantage point they're looking at it from. We only need to open up our ears to listen to what Torah has to say. And on that note, I think modern Orthodoxy, broadly defined, is really in a very, very unique place to offer that. I wrote an article recently for the Lair House on this subject. I'm gonna put it in the chat. And when I'm done talking, I'm going to put it on the Facebook posts as well. And in that article, I articulated three entry points for modern Orthodox Kiruv that existing Kiruv organizations don't seem to use much of. One is a diversity in terms of thought and in terms of dress. You can only need look at myself, Moshe, and Yair. We are not all representing the same style in the world. But at the same time, we were able to bridge diverse gaps, have different ways of thinking about things. Tochacha versus Hashavat Aveda for Kiruv is one example, but being able to bring in multiple perspectives, that we don't just have one particular line of thinkers. We're not just, for example, products of one yeshiva that has the Rosh Yeshiva and that Torah and that's the way to go. It's not only the Rebbe, for example, but being able to synthesize different ideas in order to create something that hopefully many, many people can come from their entry point and come in. A second entry point for that modern Orthodoxy is unique for is Torah Umada, which also is something that's hard to define, the synthesis of Torah and secular studies in the world. But let's say you're on a college campus or you're working with young professionals who have a particular way of looking at the world, particular subjects that they connect with and that they feel are an important part of them. Bringing that into their service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, allowing that to have its own meaning, not only as its own little thing on the side, but giving it a sense of religiosity in their lives as well, is something that a uniquely modern Orthodox perspective can add. And finally, the inclusion of Talmud Torah on a high level for women. Obviously not only coming from men, coming from women as well, but being able and willing to expose women who are more intellectual to Gemara, for example, to Talmudic intricacy. Being willing to allow all heights of Torah learning and Torah growth to be reached by every member of our community, rather than just 50% of the community, is something that's incredibly, incredibly important and often lacking in what we can call a more Haredi, right-wing Kiruv environment. modern orthodoxy is in a particular place to include all three of these just practically within an approach to Kiruv, and thus reach so many more people than are currently being reached by the existing common models.
Steve, thanks for that. Your presentation I found interesting in that I think you spoke a lot more to ideological factors about modern orthodoxy, right? Modern orthodoxy as an ideology, at least the way you're describing it, is both instrumentally more useful, like it might be more attractive to certain people, as opposed to, for lack of a better term, what we might call more right-wing ideologies, and more in some more essential sense, meaning to the extent that a person who identifies as modern orthodox believes that whatever they think modern orthodoxy is true, it'd be better to, you know, do Kiruv in a way that brings people closer to what we think is actually true. For me, what this raises is a sort of parallel question, I guess, which is how much is Kiruv motivated by a desire to bring people closer to some broad klal called Judaism, versus how much it's related to specifically modern orthodoxy or any given denomination, right? If I'm doing Kiruv as a modern orthodox person, have I been successful if the person I'm being makariv is now a chassid? Or have I been partially successful as opposed to fully successful? Moshe, maybe by your more halachic definition, you know, as long as you're following a sort of recognized halachic tradition, you're more or less happy.
Well, according to that, you'd have to be keeping zman in that, so I'm not sure if that'd be a success story.
If we're not talking about modern orthodoxy, we're definitely not talking about chassidut. So, and Steve, maybe your perception would be a little bit more narrow in as much as you're interested in, you know, advancing a certain set of values among the population.
But I think, you know, Yair, like what you're saying, this raises a good question, especially to Steve's definition, which is, you know, how do we quantify what successful Kiruv looks like? So if one takes a halakhic tokacha approach, simply the answer is the more observant the individual is, the more mitzvot they take upon themselves, the more careful they are about Shmiras Halakha and keeping the laws of the Torah, the more successful Kiruv has been. I mean, we could talk also about people who jump in for a moment, they're all fired up, and then it fizzles out. I mean, that's another issue we could talk about. But, you know, Stephen, I want to hear more. A lot of programs, particularly those that are just Jewish, you know, especially the non-Orthodox ones, like BBYO, you think about it, they're trying to cultivate Jewish identity. You know, if it's not, it didn't sound like halakhic observance was at the center of what you were advocating for non-Orthodox Kiruv. So if it's not halakhic observance, then what exactly is the measuring stick for success?
That's a great question. I think when we think of success, there's different ways that different groups have that. There's the model that's what we can call the spreadsheet model of success. How many people at the end of, you know, a fiscal year for you are now keeping Shabbos, keeping kosher, wearing a hat, et cetera, et cetera. How many women when they get married that you or Makarv are wearing shaitels or versus tichels versus not covering their hair? Those are spreadsheet models. That's regarding the end result of observance. And there are other models that are more what we can call sliding scale models. That it doesn't necessarily matter where they are as long as they're on a trajectory. And this is where I think it's important to differentiate Kiruv from what we can call loosely Jewish inreach, reaching into a particular group and allowing that group's values to internally become strengthened. I would include in that category various organizations that are focused exclusively on people who are already Orthodox and strengthening that identity, as well as organizations that are quote unquote just Jewish and are focusing on a more general Jewish theme divorced from a conversation about halacha and about Torah. What I think is the ideal is to understand, at least from my perspective, that the conversation doesn't begin until Torah and mitzvot are at the center. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, one clearly defined approach that has one very, very clear, very specific end game, but it does mean understanding that being a Jew comes with a certain set of obligations in the world, that it's a responsibility that we have to answer a call that we hear from the Torah that is speaking to us. And understanding that that Torah is, as I said before, in conversation with us in a way that demands a real thought out answer. And as long as people are thinking about that answer, as long as people are saying, I want to understand better what Torah has to say to me and bring it into my life and the life of my family and the life of my future children and the life of anyone who I end up teaching, that's already the beginning of a success. Where they're going to end up is largely dependent on them, but hopefully they're on an upwards trajectory. And as someone who is involved in Kiruv, that's really the goal. Getting the motion started, going up the mountain by their side, not telling them where to go or how to go or rushing them in any way, letting them make the decisions completely on their own, completely with what's best for them where they are, but also facilitating a conversation to make sure that the text that we have and the practices that we see as stemming from them are not being ignored. That it's really a conversation that they're able to hear and able to involve themselves in.
I'll take the opportunity just very briefly to share another document in the chat. I collected a number of the things that I had been reading in preparation for tonight into a Google Doc. It includes, of course, Steve's article, as well as a couple of interesting treatments by slightly more scholarly perspectives. I think it will be useful. And the reason I mention it now is because there's one passage in a chapter of Jack Wertheimer's new book, A New American Judaism, where he sort of interviews Kiruv professionals. And it sounds like from sort of self-described Kiruv professionals, halakhic observance per se, or relationship to Torah per se, isn't the only desired outcome. So they mention, he has a couple of quotes there that sound like, you know, if a person, if, you know, an Orthodox person trying to be makariv, someone who is, identifies as Reform, and that person, as a result, ends up becoming far more invested in their own Reform Jewish community, but doesn't take on any new mitzvot, but has a stronger sense of Jewish identity, that those practitioners would consider that a success, which I thought was interesting. And that seemed, the way at least he presented it, that was sort of the Derech HaMelech, so to speak, in Kiruv at work, that this was a sort of standard approach among Kiruv professionals, which I thought was interesting sort of as a counterweight to what Steve and Moshe are saying. I do want to move the conversation slightly to a more practical direction. Steve, I think we all started talking about this as a result of reading your article. There are two other articles listed on the Google Doc that sort of prefigured Steve's analysis, one by 2 years and one by like 15. So you're not the first one to the party, but I do think your treatment was well articulated and certainly started a new conversation that hadn't been happening for a while. You argued that modern Orthodoxy wasn't taking responsibility for Kiruv. So can you describe a little bit, like, what is the current landscape of modern Orthodox institutions or individuals who are involved in Kiruv right now? And if it's insufficient, give us your first thoughts as to like, why that is.
I would just add to what Yair's question, if you can address this. Toby Schaefer asked in the chat about, isn't Chabad already striking the ideal balance? So maybe to talk about how we distinguish and what makes it unique.
Sure. So if we look at Kiruv, there are really, I think, two organizations that are at the forefront, at least on the campus level. And I'm going to use the campus level just as the paradigm for right now. Those are Chabad and Olami, both of which are very, very large, very well-funded organizations that each have a particular path that they see as being the complete ideal path. Chabad being obviously Chabad Chassidus, and Olami being what we can call vaguely a moderate yeshivish Judaism. Those are really overwhelmingly the campus dominance. And outside of the campus world, again, you see Chabad, you see Eish HaTorah, you see Or Sameach. You don't really see much else. There are two organizations that are kind of out there that people often raise. One is, and people raise this in response to my article, one is NCSY and one is JLIC. JLIC is a campus organization where modern Orthodox rabbis are on campuses working within Hillel International, to provide kosher meals, minyans, eruv maintenance, etc., for an already existing Orthodox community within the campus. That is very much what I would call an in-reach model, where the constituency is already there. They know exactly what they're looking for. And if you're not coming in as someone who's already at the very least adjacent to that community, you will probably not be having a coffee date with the JLIC rabbi. There are people who do come in and who do find it very useful. And there are different rabbis on campuses who are exceptions to the rule. But for the most part, it exists to fill a need on the campus of a particular constituency and typically stays within its lane. The other example that people often throw at me is NCSY. NCSY really differs chapter by chapter. I actually had a really lovely conversation with a high up individual in NCSY after my article came out about what they can do to really bring back a modern Orthodox flavor to them. When I was growing up in NCSY, and I actually decided to become religious while I was a part of NCSY, but I was one of maybe three or four public school students in my entire region that went to the bigger activities. I felt very, very alienated as someone who didn't wear a kippah all the time, at the time didn't wear tzitzis. It was really overwhelmingly day school students, and that was the only image I had in NCSY. Even into college and into rabbinical school, I couldn't imagine in my mind NCSY as a kiruv organization, because it was so overwhelmingly targeted in my region growing up towards day school students. Different regions are different for that, but overwhelmingly the people who are running things, as opposed to advisors who are there on a Shabbos by Shabbos basis, but people who are really running regions tend to be graduates of places like Neri Yisrael, Chofetz Chaim, more yeshivish institutions that don't represent a modern Orthodox mission in the world, though are doing very, very good things. I saw someone said in the chat mentioning MJE, and this is the time for me to mention, where does NCSY, where does modern Orthodox Kiruv actually happen? Because it does. It's just, unfortunately, very, very tiny. So you have MJE, the Manhattan Jewish Experience, which is ran by Rabbi Mark Wilds. That is absolutely a modern Orthodox Kiruv organization of the best kind. They provide learning, they provide social activities, they provide a home for Jews to experience what Torah has to offer in a decidedly modern Orthodox context. They do excellent things, but are restricted to Manhattan. Also, largely within Manhattan, but not always, you have beginner's minyanim. KJ, Kilas Jeshurun has one, Lincoln Square Synagogue has one, but otherwise you don't really see modern Orthodox figures who are unapologetically modern Orthodox in their approach, really, really active in Kiruv in a modern Orthodox setting. You have those examples. You used to have the National Jewish Outreach Project being a very, very large presence. Nowadays, it's a little bit lesser heard of, unfortunately, but it was very, very big back in the day. Rabbi Buchwald, who founded it, still goes to different shuls and advocates for modern Orthodox people doing Kiruv, much in the way that that I tried to do. But you don't really see this outside of those spaces so much. What you do see, and this is grown, is people who identify as modern Orthodox, who are products of modern Orthodox institutions, working with organizations that are not themselves modern Orthodox. That was something that I referenced in my article as well. That at the end of the day, places like Aish, places like Olami do hire graduates of Yeshiva University who are not necessarily your cookie cutter yeshivish types. And they are doing excellent work in their places. I truly love the Aish shul that I am a part of, despite coming from a YU background. But I acknowledge that it's not the same hashkafa that I was imbued with during my time in rabbinical school. And part of me wishes that there were organizations that were not only in Manhattan, but let's say in Toronto as well, that were doing specific outreach work with a specifically modern Orthodox flavor, which is really what I tried advocating for in my article.
All right, Steve, you answered half my question, but I'm gonna hold you to the other half, which is why isn't it happening? And I'll specifically mention this in a broader context. I think it was Adam Furziger, one of the articles mentioned, distinguishing between in-reach and outreach. The title of the article is actually along those lines. It's an article in the journal Modern Judaism, Between Outreach and Inreach, Redrawing the Lines of the American Orthodox Rabbinate. He surveys a number of rabbinical schools and whether they're interested in doing outreach or not. And in that article, he makes the historical observation that modern Orthodoxy had been more involved in outreach type movements towards the middle of the 20th century. I think I see Toby describing that NCSY had more of a role in that way. He describes how Lincoln Square Synagogue and Rabbi Riskin, Rabbi Buchwald, and figures like that have been very active. YU had many more programs, sort of dedicated to outreach and to less affiliated Jews. And then he notes that there's been a shift, that he seems that the cure of world is YU Seminar. Exactly. I'd forgotten the title. Thank you, Toby. And he notes now that the cure of world is largely dominated by Chabad or by more right-wing organizations. So what changed? Why do we no longer do, why does modern Orthodoxy no longer do cure of the way it used to?
That's a great question. In my article, I tried to outline a few different reasons, at least that I assumed this was. Part of it has to do with the fact that oftentimes doing kiruv entails making significant sacrifices in where you are living, what kind of communities you are living in. Happens to be not all places that are like that. For example, in Manhattan, in Toronto, you can live in a really robust Jewish community while also being engaged in it. But a lot of times it involves moving to places that don't necessarily have the type of infrastructure that one would be used to. And this is the second reason, is that there seems to be a growing lack of passion within the modern Orthodox community for what we believe. I know relatively few people who are products of modern Orthodox institutions who are willing to say that I think Judaism is true with a capital T, and I'm willing to put myself on the line to go out there and try to show other people that it's true as well and get them to live their lives according to the truth that we have. And as a result of that, you just don't see people wanting to put themselves in those positions, not going out of their way to talk to new people and introduce them to this concept called Judaism. You don't see people really making the sacrifices in their own lives to be able to do that in the same way that you see, for example, Chabadniks, I think, are an excellent example, moving to literally the middle of nowhere to be the first shul, the first mikvah in their communities. You don't see so many people coming from YU doing that. Another reason for this can also just be the fact that, frankly, we don't really seem to know what we stand for. We've been kind of jumping around this not defining modern Orthodoxy, but I think that's part of the problem, is that we don't really have a decided definition of what modern Orthodoxy means, and therefore we can't articulate what we believe in a way that's compelling not only to others, but even sometimes to ourselves. And if we can't define ourselves and where we fit in the Jewish world, so why should we be on the front lines? And all of this leads to people taking a step back and letting the ones who are confident in this work and are willing to make those sacrifices and are willing to really go into this type of activities to lead the charge. And that unfortunately leaves the modern Orthodox perspective lagging behind significantly.
Right. So Steve, I would actually, I'd agree with most of your assessment, and I want to really just dig a little bit more into what I think David Celis, what David Celis pointed out, where he talked about our confidence, I would say confidence in our own ideology, but also among those who are most resoundingly in principle modern Orthodox, faith in the faith itself. An uncomfortable point to bring up. I think you'll find that there are those who are, since we're using YU as the chief modern Orthodox institution in America, you'll find that there are musmachim who just, see YU as fundamentally the same thing as the Haredi world. And so for them, it's much easier to join something like Olami, to join something Ish, which are already pre-existing organizations, the infrastructure is already there. And, look, maybe I'm more open to watching a movie, Torah movies, but otherwise I'm pretty much on the same page with that. And for those who are more fundamentally modern Orthodox, those who are more pushing that ideology, I find especially among that camp where there is a lack of conviction. And we could talk about whether it's intellectual humility, but I think there's a lack of conviction as well. Whether it be a simple lack of conviction of, oh, you know what? Let's say it's a YU guy, maybe the Open Orthodox got it right, maybe the Halakha Egalitarians got it right. You know, you're just looking to the people to the left of you saying, you know what? Maybe the people are more progressive than me really got it right. And I think this comes to an issue also of where apologetics comes in. You see, if you are apologetic about what you stand for, you cannot, you don't have the motivation to try to sell it to anybody else. If I don't feel like what I'm doing is ideal, if I'm always apologizing for orthodoxy, I'm always apologizing, yeah, you know, I really wish we could do better and be more progressive and more modern, then why would I try selling my brand to anybody else if I already have these doubts? There's a separate question, which is once someone is mono-orthodox and studying, you know, academic Bible and other things, I see our friend Joseph Scars here, you can appreciate this, it could bring in further theological doubts, which certainly would preclude someone from wanting to push their brand of religion and ideology. So I just wanted to dig more into what I think you were alluding to, Steve.
Yeah, for the record, I didn't study academic Bible in undergrad, and I'm still here.
Some are, some aren't.
So did I, and I'm also here. I think one related piece that I think is worthy of being mentioned, which I think has to do with what both Moshe and Steve were alluding to, and has to do also with this balance of outreach and inreach. It seems to me that there's a certain perception that even within the community, inreach is almost a kind of outreach. I remember a piece by Rabbi Shaul Robinson, I think in 2013. This was back when there was the whole hullabaloo about you know, women putting on tefillin and SAR and the whole background there, which was feels like quite a long time ago. And I think he made the claim in that article and discussing, you know, that among other issues, that even within, you know, modern Orthodox schools and institutions, building greater degrees of affiliation and commitment is really the job. And on some level, he would argue that any modern Orthodox mechanech is also a makariv, in as much as many families that are raised modern Orthodox, that send to modern Orthodox institutions and so on, are sort of seeing that as a kind of cure, as a way to get closer, as opposed to we're already in and now we're just, you know, learning the texts and learning the information. There's really a sense that you're also doing some kind of identity work and also some kind of increased level of commitment, and in a community of limited resources, you know, prioritizing our own family or the family of our immediate community is a very natural choice, as opposed to thinking outside of those boundaries.
Yeah, can I raise a question?
Please.
Yeah, so something I've been thinking about, I'll share the link here, an article that I wrote on the topic, and this is kind of how part of Kiev conversation, the way this really started, by the way, this program we put together, was that we were all writing our Kiev articles and bouncing ideas off each other, so we thought, you know, let's bring these ideas to the public. One question, which I think, oh, sorry, I direct messaged it, I didn't send it to the group. Only Steve got it. There you go. Now you will have it. So one question that has really bothered me, and I think this is what caused a lot of people to get disillusioned with Kirov, is, are we willing to sugarcoat things? Are we willing to fudge the facts in order to bring people in? Do the ends justify the means? I'm not going to go through all the literature right now, but you look especially Revelio Dessler's formulation in Michtam Eliyahu, which Professor Mark Shapiro cites in his book on changing the immutable, which is like the anti-Kirov book, so to speak. It seems that many people are willing to either sugarcoat their presentation of halakha, of Jewish theology, or omit sources in order, as a Hechi Timsa, to bring people in closer. And just two issues of that. First of all, fundamentally, is there an issue of Ziyapa Torah, that one is misrepresenting the Torah? And number two, even if it does work, is that really practically effective? Because I've met people who they were on that high, they're brought in by that inspirational charismatic speaker. And then a few years later, they're like, oh yeah, that whole spiel about, men and women, women being better than men, and that's why they don't do meditation. My grandma actually is a very silly argument, and that didn't work for me. And now they're back to either off the dark or at least very disillusioned with orthodoxy. So I'm not going to talk about the yeshivish world, but the modern Orthodox world, is that something that we see being done? Is that something that's appropriate to be done? Is one allowed to omit certain sources in order to bring people in? Does the ends justify the means? So I want a heavy question. Yeah, here, Steve, have at it.
There was an excellent, really, really articulate Facebook post about this recently by a gentleman named Elad Neharai. I don't believe he's on Facebook anymore. At least I tried finding his account and could not recently. But he became a Baal Tshuva through Chabad and has since left the Orthodox community. There was a lot that happened in between. Really, really fascinating person. But he had an article, he had a Facebook post recently, very, very long, about how he didn't know certain things about Judaism that were really, really important to know until he was already engaged to his wife. And at that point, you know, the only way for him to go on was either to be in this situation of feeling intense dissonance about something he wasn't prepared for within Judaism, or breaking off his engagement with a girl that he loved. And he talked about how difficult that was. He did not break off the engagement. He stayed with her. But it's really, it was a tremendous, tremendous post that really got into, I think, the nitty-gritty of this question. That ultimately, if we are not honest with people, if we try to sugarcoat things, it can hurt much, much, much more down the road. Not only the people in question, but come back to bite the community as well. Because what kind of a community needs to present things in a way that's lying in order to get people? I don't think there's any justification to misrepresent. On the other hand, we do need to use tact in allowing people to see what a Torah lifestyle is like. There's what to be said to the people who say that you come for the cholin, that you form relationships, you have conversations, and people can see what Judaism is like at its best, and then make a decision to at least look into it. But when they're looking into it, we need to make sure that they're looking into it openly and with full transparency, answering questions when asked in an honest and coherent way, understanding that sometimes the answers are not going to be able to be the prettiest in the world, but also understanding that if someone is truly going to be convinced that we possess the truth, that we possess the MS, it needs to be on the truth's terms. And it needs to be something that they can appreciate for what it is, not for what it's propped up to be. And if we're able to do that in a way that's smart, in a way that's kind, and in a way that allows these people, in a term that I actually heard from a Hillel director, that allows them to see what their own Jewish constellation looks like and walk with them down those lines, helping them find how Torah has something to say to them, as I've been saying for this entire time, bringing that all together, that's the way to go about it. Not by lying, not by misrepresenting, not by trying to sell something that isn't there, but by being honest and presenting the truth on its own terms.
Very good. Yeah, you're...
Yeah, one piece I'll raise, which I think, you know, gets back to the modern Orthodox appellation of our topic. And I think this goes back to Avi's point from, you know, way back at the beginning about how sometimes the ideology is of modern Orthodoxy is either complex or subject to ripe debate, though I'm sure that's also true of ideologies of other subsects and denominations. But to the extent that modern Orthodoxy might be complex or subject to debate, I could see an argument that would say, okay, like in order to you know, get enough commitment to appreciate the complexity and not see it as a turnoff, you know, presenting our preferred vision is somewhat justifiable. I'm not sure where I stand on that. I could be convinced otherwise. And I think Steve's distinction between tact and misrepresentation, I think, is important. There's a, you know, one question about the order in which you present things. You know, to be perfectly clear, like students who grow up modern Orthodox have the same thing, right? We're not teaching them that their Jewish identity will eventually require certain sacrifices when they're married. but we'll tell them that eventually when it's appropriate. And if it's true for members of the community growing up, I could see an argument that would say it should be true also for people who are sort of entering slowly. The one key difference is that in one situation, we're talking about kids, and another, we're talking about adults. And it's possible that when working with adults, a greater degree of transparency is more justifiable. I think there was one other, I guess, perspective I wanted to raise, and I'm sure Moshe and Steve might push back on me on this. I think we might be able to deny the premise. Steve, especially you'll disagree with me on this because you wrote the article advocating in favor of modern Orthodox Kiruv. The articles I cited, or I collected, they agreed with Steve, and the ones that responded still more or less agreed with the premise that it would be better were there more modern Orthodox rabbis and lay people involved in Kiruv. I could question that and say, maybe not. Meaning, maybe it's great that there are Jews out there who are involved in Kiruv, and Chabad does a great job, and Olamid does a great job, and lots of these organizations are effective in terms of increasing commitment in various kinds of ways. And Jack Wertheimer collects a little bit of data about this. He argues that we're not exceptionally effective, but moderately effective. And maybe modern Orthodoxy could afford to focus on other things. I know, Steve, in your article, you referred to another The Lehrhaus article. For those who don't know, Steve was an editor of The Lehrhaus, so he is certainly partial to their content, which I also enjoy, by Gil Pearl, arguing that different subsects of the broader Jewish community tend to have their own driving essential values. And he mentions that Chabad's essential value is Kiruv, and maybe religious Zionist communities have the essential value of Israel, and Haredi communities might have essential values of Limud HaTorah and things like that. Maybe we just don't need to be involved. And as long as the niche is being filled, why should we be doing this? So Steve, I'm sure your perspective, Moshe, I'd be curious to hear yours, because I know what Steve's going to say. I don't know what you're going to say. So let's start with that.
So I'll respond first. I actually need to leave in a minute. I have a prior commitment, unfortunately, that got moved to now and I can't avoid. At first, I just want to make a correction. I am not an editor of The Lehrhaus. I did social media work and website work for them. It's a very lovely organization that I am indeed partial to.
All of modern Orthodox Facebook, by the way.
Yeah, but not because I'm an editor.
It's a conspiracy.
Fair enough. But I do want to respond, and this is also responding to someone who in the Facebook chat earlier, not in Facebook chat, in the Zoom chat earlier, brought up, isn't Chabad already like the ultimate paradigm of Kiruv? Why do we need something like that? Can anything really top what they're doing? And I think the answer, frankly, is Chabad's not going to work for everyone. And a yeshivish approach to Judaism is not going to work for everyone. And if there is no modern Orthodox presence in Kiruv, then people who might be convinced that modern Orthodoxy is where they're meant to be will never be able to find it, because they'll never see representation there. Women will never see women learning Gemara at a very, very, very high level if modern Orthodox women are not involved in Kiruv, who are at that level. Students who have a particular academic approach will never understand that they can integrate that with their Torah studies unless they see mentors, men and women and lay people, who are actively engaged with that in their lives. It's incredibly important to have representation of that vision. And if even a handful of people say, this is the path for me, I cannot imagine Judaism without this path. This is what I am able to embrace so that I can hear everything that Torah has to say to me and bring it into my life in a way that I can pass on to my children and grandchildren and students, then it is worth it for modern Orthodox individuals to be engaged in Kiruv, men, women, rabbis, lay people, everyone to see that we can, in fact, not only understand what Torah has to say to us, but give that Torah to others as well. On that note, I actually need to go for the evening, but thank you guys so much. I'm sure the conversation is going to be really, really great. And thank you all for coming.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Brother Steve. Yair and I will stay, I guess, until 8:30. Just finish up the conversation and take any remaining questions. Is that good with you, Yair?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Okay. To answer the question, I think Steve just made a very compelling case, and I think I'd be mostly in agreement with him on that, actually. The representation, I think, is very important. But again, not speaking prescriptively, but more descriptively of what I'm seeing. I don't have stats on this, I'm admitting it. But when you think about who's willing to go out to these campuses. I mean, number one, you know, you have people like me who grew up like near the five towns or Teaneck. How many of us are really willing to leave like the Northeast? Like, you know, maybe we'll go somewhere like, you know, in Fairlawn, New Jersey, somewhere a little further. But how many of us are actually willing to venture out? I'm in Stamford now, Connecticut, so far away from New York. I think that's one thing to consider. So there was another point I was going to make, but here. Did you answer the question?
Do I have an answer to my own question?
Yeah, do you have an answer to your own question?
Way to hold my feet to the fire. I think my answer tends to line up more with what Hart was saying in the chat, and I appreciate him making that observation, that on one level, it's just about numbers, meaning if we could get, you know, take the thousands of Chabad Shlichim who are working incredibly effectively to run programs that attract, you know, over the year, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and we added another, you know, 1,000 modern Orthodox rabbis to the team, like, it would only help. And to the extent that we feel a real sense of service, and an obligation to less affiliated Jews, you know, is the concept of, for example, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazem might motivate maybe Hashavat Avedah, maybe other forms of halachic traditional arguments. I think you would just say, the more we could do, the better. And it's a question of numbers. And I think Steve's points were also compelling to me, that there are some people that will never be attracted by certain models that might be attracted by what modern orthodoxy has to offer.
Well, I think, you know, okay, I just remember my second point. I think one of the challenges, and this ties a little bit in, not exactly connected to the geographic issue, which is in the modern Orthodox world, unlike our more yeshivish counterparts, there is a huge emphasis on one building a professional career. And I mean, I'll just put my cards out on the table, just strictly, maybe it's something I should overcome, you know, maybe just my Yitzhahara. But I think the way the Velt looks at it, as if you're a pulpit rabbi versus a JYC rabbi, a pulpit rabbi is just considered more respectable. Your opinion carries more weight than, I mean, it's the same issue for teachers also. I know, yeah, you're working as a teacher. Even though you and I have the same education, we learn the same Torah, we took the same bechinas more or less, and you probably know more than I do. There is this, not just perception, I'm sure even payroll, if you look at payrolls, it can come down to it also, that pulpit positions or having a position at a very, you know, well-to-do day school might trump what some of these career positions are offering. So I think it does come partially to the question of dedication. Are you willing to do it nonetheless? Which leads me to a point that I actually made today on a Facebook post that Steve tagged me in, which is some of these ideas of going out in the middle of nowhere or becoming even just a JLIC couple for a few years, it requires not just your buy-in, but it requires your spouse's buy-in as well. And not just buy-in. For instance, Marissa and I, when before I went to pulpit for, you know, a hot second there, I was like, maybe we should look into JLIC. Maybe that'd be fun for a few years. But my wife has a career. She's very passionate about what she does. And so for us to go middle somewhere where she doesn't have a guaranteed job, and then on top of that, not only does she not have a guaranteed job, but the job I have expects her to work also in my profession, whereby she can pursue her own ambitions, her own career, that's not just asking of the rabbi, that's a huge ask of the spouse who might have their own ambitions professionally. And especially, this is a challenge in modern Orthodoxy, which I'm not saying for better or for worse, but both the man and the woman generally have a professional career. And so it's hard to reconcile that. You know, like the Rebbetzin doesn't always want to be just a sidekick into the husband's career. It's not easy. And I'm not such a progressive guy. I'm just saying descriptively, this is what it is.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think we should probably wrap up with this to give an opportunity to, open the floor more explicitly and formally. Than we already have, though I've been a big fan of the chat. You may notice I've been responding to some of the posts. I haven't been able to respond to everything. The lifestyle point's really interesting. And I think, you know, going back to Adam Furziger for a second, he notes that sort of correlating with the decline in modern Orthodox Kiruv activity, there's a huge increase in, I guess, more right-wing Orthodox, yeshiva or Haredi Kiruv organizations. And he attributes that to, you know, partially this question of, you know, ideological strength, you know, yeshivish ideology and community, you know, has really grown and flourished in the past several decades, and that has led to, you know, increasing ability to hear over, as modern Orthodoxy hasn't as much. But he also makes a sort of economic observation, which is that Kirov provides a great economic space for someone who's been learning in yeshiva for 12 years and has few other marketable skills to feel like they're, you know, have a career that's very meaningful. And given that there's so much Kirov to be done, as long as you could find the donors to support or the organizational or institutional support, you're really going to be able to sustain yourself financially. So, you know, many of these issues can be solved or addressed, you know, with certain kinds of economic perspectives. And I think this is one area where the economics really plays into the picture.
Absolutely.
Okay, it's 8:28, and I think, Moshe, if you don't mind my sort of closing out, or at least closing this this part of the conversation, you know, I think we've talked about many aspects of Kirov in general, Kirov from a modern Orthodox lens, and Kirov from a modern Orthodox sociological perspective, right? What does it mean for our community to be involved in Kirov? I suspect that many in this room would identify as some kind of modern Orthodox, and so I'd love to hear, you know, your perspective on some of these issues. I know David has been, you know, making almost an alternative case for modern Orthodoxy that would make it very difficult to do Kirov, and I'd be curious to hear that. And then more broadly, I'd love to hear other thoughts on some of the topics we've been discussing today.
Just to clarify, are you opening up the floor now, Yair?
Yeah, I should have been clear.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
People want to
David, like, please, I know you've been... Oh, sorry, Moshe. One second.
Hit like the digital raise your hand button in the reaction section, and I'll unmute you so you can ask a question. So just to say, this is like, you know, we're done with our monologuing, so now we're going to bring people in and we'll stay on for a little longer. Okay, anyone have a raised... Oh, yeah, okay, David Sellis. You're on the top of my list over here. Let's see if I can unmute you. Did it work?
So I'm just going to try and just to, not exactly to be an against Nick, but just to try and push 2 points. One is the question of what's the end game for Kirov? If the end game is I identify with community X, I want to make you want to be part of community X. That's one very specific trajectory, which I think we could look at. Chabad is complicated because we want more engagement, but ultimately we really do want you to be part of our community. Let's use like Olami as that first model. I think the much more complicated model, and I think this could be the space that modern Orthodoxy really makes is its own. I'm actually going to identify with Machon, with Yeshivat Hadar, it's Nigal Yeshiva, an institution.
I was waiting for that, David. I was waiting.
Yes. The reason I identify them
I'm
is...
sorry. I'll ask you if you could just define what that means. I know that...
Halacha is binding just... Some of the details work a bit differently in ways that get essentially women obligated in the same ways as men. But the reason I think of them is they do two really different things at the same time that I think create an interesting modern Orthodox model. On the one hand, they have a very specific ideology that they are pushing. The ultimate goal of their programming is to get people to join their community. But on the other hand, they're also pushing greater engagement with Jewish text. So there's a space between the particular community and them doing all of this online learning that is just Jews. Here is your text, engage with it. The point of that is to get people to support their community, but it's not pushing it in the same upfront way. And I wonder if that's an interesting space for modern Orthodox Kirov, which is to say it's about empowering people in terms of text knowledge and direct engagement with learning, with text, with tefillah. Where they go with that is their choice.
So thank you for bringing in the point of Hadar. I was waiting the whole session for you to drop the name. I think Rabbi Hart Levine, who is an expert in Kirov, I think works from Mizrahi and the Beis Kuni originally, wrote a counterpoint about how many unaffiliated Jews go to Hadar. I think not many. Rabbi Levine, if you're comfortable unmuting, I'm happy for you to express your thoughts. You've had a few ha'aros throughout the session. If you're in a position to unmute, I don't know if you are.
Sure, I can speak briefly. So I think, just to respond to David's point, I think Hadar does a great point at getting people involved in their community and their form of Judaism. But my sense is most people that they're reaching are people who are sort of part of the conservative movement or the left-wing Orthodox movement. I mean, I'm not an expert in Hadar, but just my sense from sort of knowing them from the periphery is that they're not reaching people who are totally unaffiliated with sort of basic Judaism classes. If you look at most of their classes, they're actually, they're very into like sort of high level Jewish learning in the egalitarian setting, which is great for the community, but it's not so much doing sort of like unaffiliated people off the street outreach.
Very good.
Right, and text knowledge in particular, I think, is a huge barrier to entry, right? If you're going to build Kiruv primarily on text and not primarily on other forms of engagement and connection, I think you're going to have a very hard time with, I guess, you know, those with less literacy, which the less affiliated you are, I suspect the less literacy you'll have in Jewish texts.
Right. And it's interesting, actually, there was a whole program that Hillel started doing, maybe like, I think in like 2010, where they said, instead of just doing outreach just by, you know, social events, they said, we're going to try doing actual like Jewish learning as a form of outreach. They did a whole like program for the same Jewish educators, and they were sort of like saying like, we have this crazy model, let's like teach people Torah to get them involved in Judaism. But like that's the model that all the Aish and the Olami people use. If I don't know if they're the only tool, but a large tool that they do use is doing text study and Torah study. But they've developed a lot of tools and resources that make it very accessible and sort of like basic, a beginner's Judaism. Think of all the Aish sort of fundamentals of Judaism courses that they have. So they've really worked a lot on that, as opposed to in modern Orthodoxy. And my sense with Hadar also is they have, you know, and we have a very great high level Jewish learning, but we haven't really developed so much basic Jewish text study.
Right. Sure. Very good point. Very good point. Thank you, Rabbi Levine, for weighing in on that. Does anyone else have want to raise a digital hand? Okay, I see my grandfather is raising a hand. You don't know how to do the digital one, so that's good. Also, let me unmute you. You can unmute now, Zadie. There.
Okay.
Zadie.
Yeah, I found the discussion very interesting, but I have a perspective, and having been on the face of the earth for 81 years and a few days, and having gone through Kiruv, I think I can offer a perspective that might be helpful. I originally joined a conservative synagogue because Bubby wanted to belong to a synagogue. I wasn't particularly anxious, but she wanted to affiliate. We had two choices in our general area, none of them Orthodox of any flavor. One was conservative and one was Reform. Reform synagogues have organs, which is too much like a Christian church for us. And so we didn't want to join that synagogue. So we joined the conservative synagogue. And what I learned in that conservative synagogue, that was the members were not observant. They showed up by car on Friday night. We had our prayer service. And then we'd either drive home or some of us would drive to the local diner for a snack and conversation, then drive home on Friday night. And Saturday, we went about our own lives. After a while, we got a new rabbi, happened to be Orthodox. Jeff Wartenberg was his name. And Jeff had an interesting perspective. There are two types of Jews, those who are observant and those who are yet to become observant. And he would stand there on Friday night, because that's where the people were there, and he would hold up the Guide to Conservative Judaism. And he would lecture us in a persuasive manner on a particular act of observance, whether it be kashrus or Shabbos observance, whatever it might be. And he would say, don't take it from me as an Orthodox rabbi. This is your text, the Guide to Conservative Judaism, and that's what this says. You couldn't argue with him when he said that. I don't know Bubby's mindset, but as for me, the more I learned, the higher the guilt level rose, and therefore I backed into an aspect of observance. And I continued to back up until it became time to sell the house and buy a house 6.5 miles away to join a young Israel synagogue within walking distance. And my perspective is that I don't see modern Orthodoxy as a defined segment. I don't see yeshivish as a defined segment. I see a spectrum of observance with a uniform commitment to halakha, to the 30 observance of the 30 malachas and everything that stems from it. And there may be different cultural approaches to it, and the Hasidim have their multiple approaches, because they're not all identical in their approaches. And different yeshivas have somewhat different approaches. And to me, before I ever heard of modern Orthodoxy as a defined segment, when you were agreed you can't quite define it, to me, modern Orthodoxy meant modern moderns today, whether it's a modern car or it's a modern house or modern anything. Modern Orthodoxy is Judaism today. And I've davened in your shul a couple of times. I don't see any difference from davening in my shul, which is theoretically a young Israel, but is being run by a very yeshivish rabbi who said, if you have to daven in a modern Orthodox shul, don't go there. It's better to daven by yourself. I don't accept that.
Right.
My perspective is that people have to learn what Judaism is, and they have to be shown the beauty of it. And then many of them will have a guilt level, and they will back into observance one step at a time.
So I think So thank you, Zadie, for sharing the anecdote and the perspective. I think that, you know, that really gets to the core of the question of Kira. Are we trying to actively convince people, or like what you said, are we presenting them with the education so that they can come to the conclusion on their own after, like what you said, all of the guilt finally culminates in that decision. So thank you, Zay, for sharing that perspective.
And I wanted to point out one other thing, if I may. In the shul that I belong to, the Young Israel, in Patchogue, my first Orthodox shul, we took an approach that every Jew is welcome. If you're going to drive, please park, please, not mandatory, please park in the shopping center a block away. Don't park in front of the shul in our parking lot on Shabbos. Everybody is welcome, and we want to have you here. And that provided a basis for Kerev.
Right. Well, okay. Well, I guess different shuls will have their own perspective. As you know, here at a good shalom, it's a little different. But like you said, everything's a spectrum. So I just want to make sure we address any other outstanding questions. Does anyone else have a question or a ha'ara, an insight that they wanted to share before we wrap up the session, or anything that you wanted to hear Yair or I weigh in on beforehand, before we conclude? Okay, so my friend Rabbi Yair Lichtman and Rabbi Steven Gottlieb, who will hopefully be viewing what he missed over here, I want to thank you for your time and Yair for putting all that work into writing down some of the questions we wanted to address. Again, this was really just a casual conversation of us trying to address and share the questions that are on our mind. We weren't coming to any definitive final conclusions, but if this is something that you enjoyed listening to and you want to hear us do something like this again, I'm sure, you know, we have opinions on a lot of things and we're amenable to sharing them on other, at least I'm very opinionated, if you've never caught that somehow. So happy to share our haros on other topics as well. And if this in theory would become something regular, we're happy to bring guests on, all sorts of different backgrounds to diversify our portfolio. So please be in touch and please do share your feedback with us either privately or on the Facebook. Okay, Yair, good.
Moshe, thank you very much. Appreciate using your Zoom account in particular. But also,
thank you, Agudah Shalom, for giving us the Zoom account for tonight. This is in lieu of my regular share. All right, take care, everyone. Laila Tov.
Thank you so much.